I just put those things on the board because those were a couple of important things from last time that'll be convenient to have to be able to refer to. Remember that what we found, well, yeah, so we were, we're looking at the group GL2, and we're looking at orbital integrals for, well, let me write down the various things. G is GL2. K is GL2O. Thank you. Thank you very much. Yep. We're looking at the group G, the subgroup K that's contact open, and we are looking at these functions, F M minus M, which is the characteristic function of the double coset of the diagonal matrix where you have pi to the M and pi to the minus M. And where do these things sit? These are inside of, these are compactly supported functions that are bi-invariant under the group K. And actually, there are other ones. We really should have, you know, F, M, comma, N, as we did in the beginning, where M is bigger than or equal to N. But the only ones that we ever get non-zero integrals for the elements we're considering, are these. And so we reduce to considering just those guys. All right, so that's kind of what we were doing. And we're looking at elements gamma, which are in K, and we're trying to compute the orbital integrals for these elements that are in K of these functions. All right, remember that I'll put down here, you get zero unless N is minus M. That's why I'm not bothering with the rest of them. Equals whatever. We're trying to work that out. What did we arrive at so far? Well, we're calling this space of functions script H, all right? Just these ones that are K by invariant. And our conclusion so far, let me summarize what we've done. So far we've seen that if we take some special kind of gammas, which are like this, but even more special, namely suppose that they're elliptic and regular. So assume that gamma elliptic regular, which is equivalent to saying that the set of vertices in the tree, B was the set of vertices in our tree, fixed by gamma, is finite. And put a for all sign. For every elliptic regular gamma, we saw that when we look at the linear functional given by that orbital integral and restrict it just to this rather small space of functions, but that's nevertheless infinite dimensional, no matter what we take, it's a linear combination of L0 and L1. O gamma restricted to H is a linear combo of L0 and L1. Moreover, last time I mentioned that the significance of L0 and L1 is that they themselves are restrictions to this smaller space of functions of orbital integrals. L0 is the given by the orbital integral taking just the value at the identity. That's the orbital integral for the conjugacy class of the identity. And this one here is also a unipotent orbital integral, but for the non-identity unipotent orbit, namely the regular unipotent. And that's what we are going to see next. So now, oh, okay, so recall L0 is simply take the orbital integral for the identity element and restrict that to H. That orbital integral simply being take the value of the function at the identity. But now, so next, let's try to understand how orbital integrals work for this unipotent element. Next, let's see that L1 is the restriction of that unipotent orbital integral to H. for a suitable normalization of the measures that are involved here. In fact, let's think about that first off. What's the centralizer? Okay, so this would be my gamma. For the moment, we focus in on that particular gamma, which is unipotent. What's its centralizer? That's an easy calculation. It's going to look like things of the form something on the diagonal, that same thing, zero and whatever, anything. A is not zero. Or in other words, we can explain it in sort of nicer terms as being Z. Z was the center. Remember that Z is just the guy's shorthand. It looks like this. Okay, Z consists of all the scalar matrices, non-zero scalars, times something I will always call N. N is then obviously guys that have this form. That's the unipotent radical of the obvious upper triangular Borel that everybody always, Borel subgroup that everybody always uses. All right, so in this case, that's what the centralizer comes out to be. We need a measure on this thing. This is just a direct product here, so I need to tell you the measures on these individual guys. This one looks like F cross. This one looks like F. And as you might guess, I will normalize my measures so that the measure of each of those is 1. The measure of the two things on that line is 1. Or in other words, that on the centralizer, if you take things in O star here and in O there, that subgroup gets measure 1. And as usual, our measure on K will also, we will normalize the Haar measure on G to give K measure 1. Now we can make a definite calculation, and I claim we will arrive at this fact that we get L1. Let's think about how we can do a calculation of a unipotent normal integral. This will provide an example of where you're adding up a convergent infinite series. It'll turn out to be a geometric series, a really simple one involving Q inverse. Okay, what do we have to do here? Remember that we have the set X that came up. It comes up here. This set X is just G mod K. But then we also had the closely related set, the set of vertices in the tree, and there you have to mod out also by the center. Okay, so we were using these things over and over again last time, just the same as before. And there's a map like that, just. And suppose I take an element X and then write V for the corresponding vertex. Let's think about how this stabilizer is going to kind of thing is going to work. We need to know about this stabilizer here. Well, it's an easy thing. I'll let you think how it goes. The stabilizer of some point that I've called X in X, the stabilizer of it in NZ, which is the thing we have to worry about. Well, I call it ZN, but whatever. This is equal to the stabilizer in N of V times, well, Z intersect K, which is Z intersect K is O star. You have to think that through, but that's how it works. And another, that's just one thing to bear in mind. Another thing to bear in mind is this is just the obvious fact that I've already said that X modulo Z is V. So NZ divided into X is just N dividing into the set of vertices. That means that here, when we look in this index set for that sum, the centralizer is NZ, and we have to divide it into X. It just boils down to looking at the orbits of N on V. That's what this thing here is going to boil down to. All right, so now do the boiling down. I'm just going to tell you, so therefore, using this way of calculating orbital integrals, it's up here, what do we find? We find that the orbital integral for this unipotent element of our, okay, as before, you know, we get zero unless we have a function where the two indices add up to zero. So I just consider those functions. and we get as our result a sum. I just explained why the index set is what it is. It'll be a sum over vertices mod n, but satisfying, well, let me, I need to put that condition that I forgot before. I'll put it below there. But anyway, we've normalized things so that k gets measure 1, so we just have 1 up there, and using these things I've mentioned, we have measure in n of stabilizer in n of the vertex v. All right, so it's more convenient. We've sort of written everything in terms of vertices rather than things in x. It's slightly more convenient. X, the space of x consists of all lattices. The space v consists of all lattice classes. It's just a little more convenient. I may say something about the lattice point of view, or we'll see. Anyway, you don't need that for what we're doing. Now we have to evaluate what things are actually going to come up in this sum. We don't get all the v's, and I'm going to just write the condition below on this blackboard. The condition, when we discussed this kind of thing last time, you have to sort of work out what this means. Okay, so what this thing means, we discussed this last time. Here it's phrased in terms of x, and now we're looking at the statement in terms of v, which is closely related to x. If you think in terms of lattices, it's just the lattice class of the lattice x. And the condition was that this had to be equal to twice m. Remember that a, in this case, is the thing that's in the double coset. It has to do with m. And now, from the kind of picture we saw, this is like last time, as in last lecture. By drawing the picture of what happens to, remember that picture of the fixed point set and something moving, what really matters is is how far v is from the fixed point set. And if this distance here from the vertex to the fixed point set is m, then the distance from here to here will be twice m. And that means we're looking for, this is if and only if v has distance m to the fixed point set. All right. Now we need to work out what actually happens, and I need to recall another decomposition. I'm going to formulate it for a general split group like I did for the Cartan decomposition that we had last time, the KAK one. So let's again suppose that we've got a split group, split. That's a split maximal torus. This is a Borel containing it, and it's unipotent radical. Then what the Iwasawa decomposition says is that if we look at G, stress GF is equal to B F times G O. All right, so if we write it in our usual short terms, G equals BK. And B itself is AN or NA, it doesn't matter. So you can write this at will as NAK or ANK. And as an exercise, you might want to check this for GLN, if you haven't seen it before. Exercise for GLN. Again, this is a statement that can be proved using, I would recommend using column operations coming from K. All right, you're trying to take a matrix modify it on the right by things in K, do that by elementary column operations using K. So you can permute the columns, or you can multiply a column by something in the valuation ring and subtract it from another column. Keep doing that, and pretty soon you'll be able to get the thing to be upper triangular. It's an easy thing to see. So exercise, do it for GLN using column ops. Well, as a consequence, now we return to GL2. It's convenient to use the Iwasawa decomposition to figure out what this is, because V is, well, it's closely related to G mod K, and here we're dividing on the left by N. So certainly this decomposition, NAK, is going to let us figure out what the quotient of N dividing into V is. So let's do that. So use Iwasawa to work out the orbits of N on V. Here's the calculation. Well, just recalling what V is, it goes like this. It's you're actually divided by KZ, and we can, this Z is in the center, you can move it wherever you want. And then by the Iwasawa decomposition, G mod K is the same as B mod B intersect K. So just make that replacement. But now we have B, and one of the things we're dividing out by is the normal subgroup N. So once you divide B by M, you get A. Okay, so we get A, and then we have to see what's kind of remaining to divide out by. Well, we'll get from this will give us A intersect K, and from this, well, we'll get Z. So we'll have A divided by the center and by A intersect K. Already here, we simply get F cross. A is two copies of F cross. Z is one diagonal copy of S cross, and you get one copy like that. And when you also mod out by this, you end up with, actually, in the end, this whole thing being F star mod O star, and you just get Z. And then you have to think about how that came about in a more tree-like way. Remember that we started off with something that made sense in terms of the tree. V is the set of vertices, and now we're saying that we can find a set of representatives of the orbits of N on the vertices indexed by the integers. But how, you know, where do they sit in the tree? Well, this copy of the integers is simply the vertices in the standard department. That's where it's coming from, these guys A, and they're the things that we use to form the standard department. So now we can draw the same picture as before. This is our standard department. And on here we have vertices, you know, V0 we were using for the... Well, I think I was labeling them like this, just by the integers last time. That's the standard department. And those vertices are exactly the ones that are orbit representatives. So thus, the vertices in standard department are orbit reps for the action of N on V. That means what we're summing over is something really simple. We can just represent these vertices using diagonal matrices, because that's how you get those points in the standard department. That tells us what the index set is. It's just summing over all integers such that some condition holds. But then we need to know what that measure comes out to be. How do you do that calculation? Let's put that here. This calculation serves for two things, as you'll see. All right, so the basic thing to know, let's say we're out here at J. Let me call that V sub J just for short. All right, so V sub J is the jth vertex as you go along that standard department. Let's find its stabilizer in N. It's something that is an important thing to do for a couple of reasons. It works out to be, well, right, so N consists of all these things that look like 1, something, 0, 1, but the something, in order for it to stabilize, dj has to be in that fractional ideal, pi to the j times O. That's a simple calculation. You should do that also as an exercise because you're going to be able to do it without difficulty simply because Vj is, let me write that. What is it? It's pi j 1, 0, 0 times V0. And we know what the stabilizer of that thing is. By definition, that's the base point. The stabilizer of V0 is k times z. And the stabilizer of that new element will be a conjugate of that thing by that diagonal matrix. And so you can do this calculation easily. The way we set up our measure, in the case where J is 0, so you just get O, we would get measure 1. And everything else is sort of based upon that. And we see that this thing, this stabilizer, its measure is equal to, it's just going to be Q to the negative j, right? Yeah. Q to the negative j, because as j gets bigger, that measure gets smaller. And now we have to, we have to do two cases. So the first reason I had to do that calculation was because we needed to know these measures. But the second reason is we need to know when we're in this situation. I mean, we need to know about this distance here in the case where gamma is that particular unipotent matrix. This we can also understand because let me now make the following remark. This follows from this calculation of that stabilizer. All right, so that calculation up in the upper right implies that Vj, same meaning as before, Vj is fixed by our element gamma that we're considering, if and only if, you have to look. I mean, to be fixed is just the statement that this element lies in the stabilizer, and we worked out what the stabilizer is, so you can certainly read it off from that, and it just says that J is less than or equal to zero when you look at what that thing in the upper right says. All right, so now we can draw a picture of what this unipotent element is doing to points in the standard apartment. Well, let's draw the standard apartment once again. Here's V0, or maybe I'll just again omit the V and just use the integers. Okay. So these are, let me call that thing gamma. So these are fixed by gamma, and these are not fixed. So now you see what's happening is that if you take this element gamma and apply it to this thing, these stay fixed. And now when you apply gamma, let me draw it down below. It comes off like this. So let's call this standard apartment that kind of A for apartment, and then we can transform it by this gamma, by this unipotent gamma. And a lot of it stays fixed, the stuff over there does, and the rest of it swings down like this. Because we know it does, because we know that this one's not fixed, so that has to move. All right. And now we can answer our question as to what is the fate of, remember here, when we do this calculation, we need to know how far a vertex gets moved from itself by gamma. But our orbit representatives are simply the guys in that apartment. So as my vertex, I don't need to consider an arbitrary vertex. It's just one of the ones in the apartment. And we take it and we move it by gamma, and we see how far it goes. Well, this is obvious from this picture. The ones over here don't move, and the ones over here, they, you again get the double of how far they are from this point. So we see just from the picture what we get here. All right, so pick from picture. Read off what to label it by, but we sort of read off this thing that we need to worry about, we read off from the picture. So what's the outcome? Again, think about it at home, if you like, to see that I'm getting it correct. For this unipotent guy, if we look at the orbit integrals for F0, 0, we're counting fixed points. All right? But we're counting fixed points weighted by this reciprocal of this measure here. Okay? So in this case, it's fixed points. We're looking for all the vertices in the standard apartment that are fixed. Well, we know what those are. For each one, we have to add up the reciprocal of that measure that we found. Well, these are where the j's are negative. The measure had the negative of j, but then we take the reciprocal. So we're back to, so this thing here is 1 plus q inverse plus q minus 2. All right, so as promised, that orbital integral did turn out to be an infinite series. But nevertheless, it's fine. I mean, and we were supposed to get, I was claiming that this thing would give us this L1, and indeed we got 1 over 1 minus q inverse. That's why that thing appeared. It's just the sum of this geometric progression. And then also you have to think what the other guy is, other ones are. If m is bigger than 0, then we take the unipotent orbital integral for fm minus m, and it is well, how's it going to go? Let me just talk it through. In this sum, we're looking for vertices in the standard apartment which are moved to a distance 2m away. That means we're looking for one that's distance m away from 0, because the thing gets doubled. So we're looking at, well, and not over on this side. So there's just one term in the sum coming from the vertex that's m units away from here. We just get one term in the sum. And so we simply get q to the m. And again, that was what we were supposed to get in that formula for L1. Okay, that's how you do this calculation. Now, a remark. I promised to calculate all the orbital integrals for, all elements in K. And what would happen if we, instead of, suppose that we look at the orbital integral for this scalar matrix here. Well, to make it be in K, I want Z to be a unit. But suppose I look at that thing. Actually, it's exactly the same. It doesn't change. I mean, you can take it, it's independent of Z when you look at it on H. So it's the same as just what we already did. So it's always, well, it's just always equal to L0. And similarly, with the same notation, oh dear, there we go. If I take a unipotent guy times that scalar, and look at that orbital integral on H, I'll always get L1. Again, I'll leave that as an exercise. It's very easy. The point is that our functions are all right and left invariant under K, and therefore they're right and left invariant under K intersect the scalars, and that's O star. So somehow that O star just doesn't matter for these functions. All right. The next thing to do in working through these elements is to, in fact, this is the last thing, because we've almost exhausted all the conjugacy classes that do meet K, but not quite. We still have the hyperbolic ones. So now let's do that. Okay, so now we have hyperbolic elements. In other words, just diagonal guys. I don't want it to be in the center. We've already done that. So I want A different from B. But we want it to be in K. And so we want A and B to be units. Well, in this case, the centralizer is just the diagonal matrices, which I've been calling A. Now, we don't have to use the centralizer, as I remarked last time. If you take something which is co-compact in it, that's just as good. In this case, the most convenient thing is to take the center. That's always a good idea. But times, and I want a kind of discrete a lattice to replace the remainder of the A. And that means I want to do the following. If I wanted to get all of A, I would have to take things in the center times diagonal matrices of the form, just anything, and then a 1 there. That would work. But now, instead of taking anything there, I'm just taking, replacing F cross by Z, kind of that's discrete and co-compact in Z. That's the point. Z is discrete and co-compact in F star, just the powers of pi. That turns out to be the nicest way to do it. Here, we'll, as always, take our measures so that that gives that part, you give measure 1 to the units. And here, you use the counting measure, as you would think. It's a discrete group. And as always, measure of k will take to be 1. Okay, and now we have to write down what the orbital integral looks like on this function. Well, using our general formula here, we have to boil it down when we use g gamma prime in that formula. But then you just boil it down, and you come out to the following conclusion. Okay, so you'll need to think about that. This z here, I mean, this group, I'm just going to call it Z. So when I use Z here, it means that Z, the things that are given by matrices, which are integer power of pi up there, divided into V, such that the distance from V to the fixed point set of this gamma is M. And this is why I did things like this. This will just boil down to be 1, that the measure on top is 1, and the measure in the denominator is 1, so it's 1 over 1, it turns out. Or in other words, this time it truly is a counting problem with no weighting of any kind coming in. Well, I shouldn't use the word weight, it's not weighted orbital integrals, but anyway, over there we have coefficients of some kind. But this is just the number of elements in this set. Okay, so we have to look at, this is using the same kind of reasoning as before. We've seen over and over again that how far something gets moved away from itself will be the double of how far it is from the fixed point set. So once again, I'm just doing that here. That means we need to figure out we have to understand what the fixed point set looks like for these hyperbolic elements. That becomes the essential question. and this is an important calculation that will let us handle, this single calculation here lets us handle the elliptic elements as well, which I'm going to return to, because last time all we saw before was that when you had something elliptic regular, that we get some linear combination of L0 and L1 with some kind of weird coefficients. But it's quite beautiful what happens when you actually see what the coefficients are. Something simple happens that helps to understand Schleicher-Germs. The next thing we have to do is to understand this fixed point set, V gamma. Need to understand for our hyperbolic elements gamma of the kind I want to consider, where the A and B are units. All of our notations are the same as before. We have our Borel, our diagonal guys, our uniput and radical n, all that's the same. And now let's formulate a claim. The claim will answer this question of what vertices are fixed by these hyperbolic guys. For this, we need to define an integer. So this is a non-negative integer determined by our element, and it is needed to describe the fixed point set. So we have d gamma, and it's just simply the valuation of 1 minus, and now if I write a over b, I hope that will be, you'll see what the significance is. When we have our diagonal element, ab, where did it go? A over b is the value of the root, the positive root. All right, you've got a positive root a over b and a negative root b over a. A over b is just that root. And here is the value, so this thing is, if we, as usual, write alpha for a root, the expression we're seeing here is 1 minus a root evaluated on gamma. So this is part of some general kind of thing. But anyway, do make that definition. Now the claim that I want to formulate is that the fixed point set is easily describable in terms of this integer d sub gamma. Namely, it's just all the vertices that are within distance d sub gamma from that standard apartment. Okay, so the answer is, it's all the vertices such that the distance, I just always abuse this d for the distance for anything. Here it's distance from the vertex to the standard apartment, the shortest path distance to the standard apartment, less than or equal to this integer. If the integer is 0, we're just saying that it's all the points in the apartment, and so on. So now I want to prove that this is kind of a very basic computation, which we should do. We've got the equality of two sets, and both of those sets are translation invariant under the action of the diagonal matrices A. A preserves both of those sets, are both preserved by translation by A. That helps to understand why the answer comes out the way it does. This set of points has to be invariant under the translations coming from A, and the things in A move that apartment along. They translate the apartment along. And so if you have one point in the apartment, you have to have them all, etc. If you have one point at distance one from the apartment, you are going to get all of them, because actually the action is actually transitive on such points. But we need to see, so it's not surprising that the answer would have this general form, but we have to see that this is exactly how it works. And this is, again, a very basic sort of calculation can be used more generally. How do we do it? Because of this fact that translations by A operate in a simple way on our whole picture, and because we have that Iwasawa decomposition, and because vertices involve dividing by K on the right, we see that we really only need to answer this question for points of the form something in n times the base vertex. All right, so enough by Iwasawa. Well, and then this is a consequence of the first thing. So therefore, by Iwasawa, enough to examine points V, which are of this, any point V could be written as, you know, you can write any group element as A, N, K. So any point V can be written as A times N times the base vertex. But I want to just get rid of the A, and it's enough to consider a vertex which is of the form N times the standard base vertex sitting there. Remember, we've got our standard apartment and our standard base vertex right in the middle of that standard apartment. Okay, so now let's examine the left side, which is just by definition, we're examining whether the guy is fixed by gamma or not. Let's just examine that. Okay, so we have to answer the question, when is it, when can this happen? When can we have that equality that gamma fixes the element? Well, it's more pleasant if we transform this in a harmless way. Obviously, I haven't done anything. But why do we do that? It's because gamma fixes V0, that's for sure. Gamma has this form of a diagonal matrix with the diagonal entries being units. And such things don't, they just act by the identity on all these, on this standard apartment. We discussed last time, that the way a diagonal matrix acts upon this apartment is it translates it by something involving the valuations. It's the difference, actually, of the valuations of these guys. And when they're units, it just doesn't move them. So this thing here is V0. And now we just move this around, and the question is, take the inverse there, you know, the question becomes this. That belongs to the stabilizer of V0. That's the question that we have to examine. Conjugating a, now you see that we're doing things that are kind of standard in reductive group theory. We're conjugating something in the unipotent radical by something in the torus. So it's going to operate on it, in this case, simply by the one root that we have. That's where the root is coming from. So let's give an, let me write n as being, I need a sort of a coordinate here. Let's write n as being, and I'll put a u up there for the entry that's relevant. What happens to that thing when we, okay, so what's this thing? The inverse of this is, you know, it just negates the u, and when you do the conjugation, it multiplies u by the root. So this thing here is going to be 1 and A over B times U. And now you're going to see why this calculation is going to involve 1 minus A over B, because when we put these together, it's 1. All right, well, the way I did it, like this. Okay, whoops. The valuation of A over B minus 1 is, of course, the same as the valuation of 1 minus A over B. Times U. Thanks. Whoa. Too much Shakespeare last night. Oh. 1 o'clock. Wow. Yeah. And our condition, well, the what is that stabilizer? Remember, it's more or less GL2O, but, well, okay, Z. But it actually doesn't, that Z doesn't make any difference. It's still, the condition is, the condition that we end up getting is just this condition. And that's what we wanted. Oh, no, I'm sorry, it's not. We're not done yet. Whoops. But no, that's the first step. So we have, we have a description. In other words, we know now what's going on in something that's close. I mean, we see why that comes in. But there's one more thing to do. All right, so let me summarize it. Conclusion of what we've done so far. Gamma fixes this guy, if and only if, and gamma, n is 1, u, 0, 1. Gamma fixes that guy if and only if u belongs to pi to the minus d gamma o. Okay, that summarizes what we've done so far. We're not quite done. Now the claim, which I'm trying to prove, follows from. For n, again, I mean, I'm keeping the same notation. For one of these elements, n, we have the following. I suspect I need to appeal to the thing that was right there. Now the claim follows from, if we take our element n with that coordinate u as before, then I want to relate the valuation of u to this distance to the standard department, because that's what this answer came out in terms of, was how far to the standard department. That means that we need to understand the following point, which is also interesting and good to know. The distance from this guy, n times d0, to the standard department can be read off from the valuation of that coordinate u. And it goes like this. It's the negative of the valuation of u if the valuation of u is negative. And 0 if the valuation is positive. It's okay to write it overlappingly like that because the answer is the same either way. And that follows from, it's so perfect in some sense, this follows from the thing that's below it on the blackboard. So just click on this thing and make the thing that's hidden there come up and it would follow from it. Follows from calculation of stabilizer, from previous calculation of stabilizers in N that we did just a while ago. Let me draw the picture. This, I'm just doing an example. Suppose that we have our matrix with the valuation of u being negative 2, just for definiteness. Then the picture that goes with this, like this. The ones by our previous calculation, the vertices in the standard department, they get fixed by this thing, are these over here. These are, all this stuff is fixed, and the rest swings up like that. Because it swings up like that, here's V0. V0 moves up to there. So how far this thing is to the standard department is just how far this thing is to this. And that's all I'm saying. Okay, that finishes the proof of the claim. So we're done with, QED for claim. Now we have to use the claim to actually work out, so why were we doing this? We wanted to know what the fixed point set looked like so that we would be able to evaluate this expression here. All right, so now we know what this thing looks like, and we should be able to work out what this number is. Just in case I'm going to need that. I'm running short on time. I'm going to draw a picture and tell you the answer, and you'll have to figure out what the picture means. The horizontal line is the standard apartment. That's perhaps not too amazing. This is V. Some V that we're thinking about. Anyway, I'm just going to tell you the answer. You have enough to figure it out now. Oh, no, let me just make one remark to help. This will explain why I fix on my attention on this point here, which we can take to be V0 if we like. It doesn't really matter. What's a convenient way to take into account that we have to count things after modding out by translations? What's the best way to do that? The best way to do that is to select representatives, and the best way to do that is simply to insist that we only look at V's where the closest point on the apartment to them is this given one. That will have the effect of getting rid of the translation action. So just focus in on V0. Only look at V's such that when you join them by a geodesic to the apartment, that geodesic lands here. That's sort of the beginning of the meaning of that picture. And then it's just a pure counting problem of how many V's are at a given distance to that apartment, because that's sort of what our answer came out in terms of. You can see that, I'll say a word about it. We need the distance to be M to the fixed point set. The fixed point set goes out a distance D gamma from the apartment. All right, so we have things that are M units away from things that are D gamma units away from the apartment. That's the meaning of this picture. And now you have to see how many points there are at that location. Think about it. I just will write the answer. If we're counting fixed points, we get this is a finite series. It ends here. But that's a very nice one because it telescopes. So we get actually something completely simple. Q to the power d gamma. And now if we take the other case where m is bigger than 0, again, you'll just have to think about it. As before, you need to use, like we did last time, that every vertex has q plus 1 neighbors. Use that over and over again. Conclusion. You have to now compare these with, it's good that I saved it, actually. Compare that formula. Now we're seeing what these orbital integrals look like when restricted to the special functions in script H. Well, you see that this thing is simply, take this hyperbolic orbital integral, restrict it to these very special functions. We get q to the power d lambda times, that's occurring everywhere, times, and then if you compare with what's on the board, it's 1 minus q inverse times L1. So for all the other orbital integrals we've ended up with linear combinations of L0 and L1, and that happened again, as it was supposed to. Every single time, we get a linear combination. In this case, it's actually just L1. It's simply a multiple of L1, with the multiple depending upon that integer d gamma. And one way to understand why that might be reasonable is you can think that, let me just say something heuristically here, which can be made rigorous, but I'm not going to, I probably won't do that. Suppose we look at the matrix A 1 0 B. That's with A different from B. That thing is the eigenvalues are A and B, so it's conjugate to A B. It's diagonalizable and it's conjugate to A B. But now let A B approach 1. Now of course you're going to tell me if I hadn't put in that 1 there, I would have concluded that as A and B go to 1, that approaches the identity. But somehow that's wrong-headed because we should do it in a generic way. And the generic thing is not, I mean, that somehow you'd be going to the identity, that would be a very special thing to do. But if you take the limits of these conjugacy classes of these elements, the limit of this conjugacy class as A approaches B is actually this conjugacy class, or rather its closure. And so it's not so surprising. Remember that L1, that is the unipotent orbital integral for this guy. So it's maybe reasonable that what happens as you let your hyperbolic element go toward the identity is that you would pick up the regular unipotent orbital integral. That's a general phenomenon. Okay, so upshot. For all gamma belonging to K, the orbital integral for gamma restricted to H is linear combo of L0 and L1. And remember, well, the other thing, L0 is just the orbital integral for 1, 1, restricted to H, and L1 is orbital integral for 1, 1, 0, 1, restricted to H. Well, we're almost done with this discussion, but I can't quite finish it today. The last thing I want to do is to go back to the elliptic case, the elliptic regular case. There we had a formula saying that our restriction is a certain linear combination of L0 and L1, but there was something unknown in there. One of the things that entered in was the number of fixed points, and we don't know what that is yet. But we'll be able to determine the number of fixed points, and then there's a beautiful simplification that occurs. And the actual coefficients in that linear combination, you get something in front of L0, something in front of L1, those are called Schleicher germs, and they're nice, you'll see. You'll see the homogeneity of those things explicitly, as you'll be, I mean, those things will come up, as I said, in Hales's and DeBacher's talks, and you'll see them in this case. All right, so that's what we'll start with next time.